Okay, this is May 8th, 2024. Debbie Goldman is interviewing Gloria Middleton. We are doing the recording via Zoom. Gloria, are you in Brooklyn, Manhattan? Where are you?
In Manhattan, lifetime resident of Harlem.
Okay. I'm sure that'll be part of the story.
Yes,
And
it will.
Jeff Reckenbach is on Zoom from Cleveland, and Hannah Goldman is here in Brooklyn as well. So, Gloria, we start with the beginning. Tell us when you were born. We just learned you were born and raised in Harlem. So, talk a little bit about the community you were raised in.
Okay, well. I was born and raised in Harlem. I'm a 1950s baby. So back in those days, when you lived in the community, it was a community. My first memory is moving into what we call the projects today. It's New York City Housing Authority. And for us, that was a step up from the tenements that were in Harlem at the time. So I remember my mother and father being so happy they were getting into a new development, because that's when I believe Rockefeller had put the money into the government to make sure that they had these middle income and low income housing projects. And so I remember the day vividly, the first day we moved in, how happy we was. That's my first memory, and I was 5 years old. And growing up in the projects, as I said, we were a community. So everybody that moved in at that time, we got to know each other. We became family. I have lifelong friends that we grew up together, and we still stay in touch. Some have moved out of state, some are still here. And we're like family.
What was the name of the project?
Then it was Stephen Foster. Today it's Martin Luther King Towers.
And is it just one building or is it multiple
No, it
buildings?
was multiple buildings on Fifth Avenue, 112th Street to 115th Street, from Fifth Avenue to Lenox Avenue, which we would call Sixth Avenue, downtown.
And
So it
just
was
brief.
like 10 or 12 buildings. Yep.
Wow, that's huge. And just briefly, what was the apartment like? How many bedrooms and
Well,
brand new?
it was brand new at the time. My mother and father, I was number six of eight children. Okay, so, and she, God bless my mother and father. When we moved in, it was me. I was born. I was five. My brother was like four, and my baby sister hadn't been born yet. So we moved into a three-bedroom apartment. My older siblings, some of them were working already, because the range of ages of children were amazing. Back in those days, they didn't have birth control, so it is what it is. So, I remember in my bedroom, it was me and my two sisters, because they used to have bunk beds in those days. And the apartment was fairly large. Long hallways, big living rooms, nice sized kitchen with dining. Like I said, it was a step up. We thought we were living high and mighty. The only way my father was able to support us was for him to be in a union. He was a longshoreman, he was a laborer. The West Side Highway actually had ships that came in, and the men would have to move the packages off the barges. That's the hard work that he did. And because of him being in a union, that's how we got dental, we got medical treatments. He was able to feed eight children, et cetera. So, and he made sure to explain that to me, even as a young child, when we went to the medical office. There used to be a medical office on 6th Avenue. I remember it was Avenue of the Americas, and I looked at the sign and said, "Daddy, what's that?" He said, "That's just 6th Avenue, just named it that." And we would go into the building, and we would do our full checkups in this one building. So that stuck in my memory as well. And as a community, my parents I later learned were organizers. They migrated from the South to come to New York to get a better life.
Tell us, where did they come from? And what it
South
what
South Carolina, a
and what hit?
small town in South Carolina.
Were a lot of the people who you were friends with, your parents were friends with from South Carolina?
They were from mostly from the South, either South Carolina, North Carolina. In that period of time, a lot of blacks migrated to the North because Jim Crow was still alive in the time that they came in. My parents were born in 19, one was 1912 and one was 1916, so they had been through a lot living in the South. And both of them didn't have more than third grade education. But I call my mother a PhD. She had a PhD because she was able to take care of a household because she never worked. My father was the breadwinner. She never worked. She took care of the household. We never were hungry, obviously, and always had nice clothes. She would spend Thursdays, I remember the day, Wednesday was laundry day, Thursday was iron day, in the kitchen with the iron, pressing our clothes with starch because her children were going to look a certain way. And
Beautiful.
I carry that fashion sense to make sure I look sharp from her.
Beautiful. When we interviewed Chris and Dennis, they both grew up in the projects. A very different situation for that New York City had, I think. And so your mother, while you said didn't work, she worked very hard.
Oh,
She just didn't work for pay. How did your dad happen to get a job as a longshoreman? And were there many African Americans working as longshoremen?
I'm not sure because he started working, I don't have that memory. But the hard work when it came to being a longshoreman, lifting the bale, and I call it lifting the bale and cotton, was done mostly by the black men and, working on the ships. But the higher positions, the supervisors, the foremen, et cetera, were mostly white. Okay, the union leaders were white males, period. There wasn't even women involved in that. So I'm not quite sure how he got the job or heard about it. And he was a seasonal worker. He was always trying to get permanent status, but because of the type of work that he did, it was called seasonal.
So he had a hiring hall.
And I remember him saying he would have to go to the hall to go pay his dues. He literally had a dues check-off card, sort of like an envelope with they checked off when he paid his due, went into the hall and paid his dues. And he would show us that card. It was a yellow manila-like card with his name on it, and they would write in the date that he went to pay the dues, et cetera. I remember him showing me all of that.
International Longshoremen Union, and I believe the East Coast Union was a separate union than the West Coast Union. Different traditions. What elementary school and high school did you go to?
Yes, all right. There was a public school right across the street from the projects where we were called PS 170. Went there through fifth, was this? I went there through sixth grade. In the back of the days, they used to have these tests to check your intelligence, whatever you want to call it. And so when they tested me, they found certain children were at a higher level of learning. So they put us in what they call the intellectually gifted class. So I remember being in four IGC, five IGC, and six IGC. I'm just trying to remember because at some point they changed junior high schools from seventh grade to sixth grade. So I'm trying to remember whether I went to junior high school in sixth grade or seventh grade. But I think I went in seventh grade because the memory is coming back.
And which junior high and which high school? And were you also in an intellectually gifted class
We
at
went
the?
to Wadley Junior High School, which still stands in Harlem, by the way. And I went to what they call a special progress class. So we were in what they call the SP class. And I went there for the 7th grade and the 8th grade because that was the first year that students from the 8th grade graduated and went to high school in the 9th grade. That was the first time that that had happened. So,
My memory's already bad. Did you mention your high school?
no, I didn't. The high school was Charles Evans Hughes High School, and I went into the College Bound program.
Okay, so
Yeah.
it's I'm guessing that you got good education because you were in those classes. Is that correct?
Yes, I thought I had good education. We did all the special courses. My reading level in 4th grade, once we got into the IGC class, and I remember having a black teacher, and I was the first black teacher I had, and he made us read the New York Times every day. And I went from a 3rd grade level reading to a college level reading level. So, thought I was
In
doing
fourth
great
grade.
in 4th grade. Yes. Read the New York Times every day. You're gonna learn. And our homework was all the words we didn't know was to look it up in a dictionary and come back. Yes. That was his strategy.
But you were implying, you said you thought it was a good education.
Yes, I'll tell you why. So graduated early from college. I was supposed to graduate in June. I had all my credits, so they told me I could graduate in January.
From college or high school?
From high school. Not sure whether that was a good thing or not, but so graduating early, I started looking for colleges to go to. I had always wanted to go away to college to have that experience, but my mother, being the mother that she was, she wanted her children close to home. So I had got accepted in a state college, but then I had applied for through CUNY and City College of New York, which was on Convent Avenue in Harlem, accepted me. So I knew that was a prestigious college, and it still is, back in the day. So that kept me at home, and I thought I would get a good education there. So I started City College in February of 1969. I remember it well. Because I got culture shock when I went to City College. Had always been in black schools, had never been in a multiracial environment. And so I was going to advanced classes because I wanted English as my major, because I at the time I loved to write and I loved to read literature, et cetera. And I'd get in the class and these kids were mostly coming out of private school and coming into college. And a lot of the kids were Jewish who also went to private schools, their own, schools. And when I got in the classroom, I thought I had a good vocabulary, and that they were talking, and I was saying, what the heck are they saying? Because their language was different from mine. I came from a different environment. So, on the other hand, with the black students, City College didn't have a black studies course at that time. So the children were rallying, the black kids were rallying on campus to demand a black studies course. This college is located in Harlem, and you don't have a black studies course for students here. So, I was like, where am I supposed to be? I'm trying to get an education. I don't understand why they're rallying. What you talking about, black studies? I knew nothing about black studies. I wasn't taught that in school. I thought history was history, but I learned. So I was culture shock on both ends. So I was there for 2 years, and learned a lot. I did take some black studies courses, and learned so much of my history that was unbelievable. And I can tell you, a lot of white students took the course and they were not accepting of the history. Okay, and that another culture shock. There was so many debates in class, but that's college is where you learn. That's why you go to college. You get educated. You find out who you are. So, of course, going to college is expensive, even though I was in what they call a SEEK program, where you didn't have to pay the regular tuition. So that's how I was able to at least do those 2 years, but you still had to have books, you still have to have coffee, you still had to have, money for food, et cetera. So my sister, who worked in the community quite a bit, she found a program where you could go to college and work at the same time. So when she told me about it, I said, listen, I'm jumping ship. So I left City College, and that was in 1972, and went to work for the Department of Corrections, where there was a program where you went to work 3 days and you went to John Jay College for 2 days.
Let me just get a few facts. This, what was, which comp campus of City College was, were you at in Harlem?
There's one campus. It's on Convent Avenue. It extends from 137th Street to about 145th Street, going north of Convent Avenue all the way over to Broadway.
Oh, that's huge. I
It's
didn't
huge.
realize that. I thought there were different
No,
campuses, but there's
no.
only one.
For CCNY, it's one campus, yes.
And I thought at some point City College was free tuition by the time you
Yes.
were going there.
Yes, it was. Well, depending on your income, that's what I talk about when I say the SEEK program.
Oh.
It's capital SEEK. It had some initials. It stood for something, but that's how I was able to go. You had to apply for financial aid, and they would pay for it basically. So my tuition was basically paid for those 2 years.
You want to add anything about your college experience? I'm intrigued about you were there. You talked about the railing to get Black studies. There was a lot going on around
Yes. The yes.
Black issues and anti-war issues in
Yes,
that
and the
period.
Vietnam War, the all of that was happening around that time. So I felt very alone, because I didn't know which way to go. It was a new experience. Like I said, it was culture shock. I tried to learn as much as I could. I actually did very well in classes despite my despite what I call my lack of vocabulary, but I did okay. Even in my English classes, when you had to, you did papers, I would do my papers and the teachers would give me B's, a couple of A's. So I was doing well, but I just when you're in your 20s, you're still finding yourself. You don't know who you are.
That's interesting. And were you living at home?
I was still living at home at the time.
And just to understand a little better, when you say that the white students were speaking a different language, are you talking about literally Black English versus white English?
Exactly. We all speak English. But culturally, we have a different way of expressing ourselves. With the white students, and sometimes, people like to impress people, so they use, I call, word salad to make themselves look smart, et cetera. And I'm saying, what the hell are you talking about? Could you speak plain English? So, that's the part that used to get me. And so, but I would read my books. I would still do what I knew what to do when I was in elementary school. If I didn't understand a word, go to the dictionary and look it up. They have Google now, but I actually went to a book and looked it up.
I
There were
remember
no
those
computers.
days. Yes.
Or to the library. Go figure.
So, Jeff, I'm going to jump to her public service work. Do you want to ask anything about that we've talked about thus
No,
far or that
that's
I've
where I was
missed?
ready to jump to. I'm interested in this program, this 3 days working, 2 days at school program. So let's talk about that.
Talk about that, and I'm guessing that's what got you into public employment. But
Yes, that's what thrust me into public employment. I actually worked on Rikers Island at the Women's House of Detention, which was again a culture shock. My brother had worked there and he didn't want me to work there. But I said, listen, I need money. I can get my education at the same time. I'm going to work. So I did. Like I said, I started in 1972. In 1973, late, I think the fall of 1973, the funding for the program stopped. Okay, all good things come to an end. So they gave us the option you could work full time, and become an actual full public servant, or if you didn't want to continue education, you go into your education. Somebody that's 20, by that time I was 22, and getting whole paychecks. They were offering $6,700 a year. For me, that was big money back in the 70s. So I said, okay, I'm gonna continue to work. So that's how I got into public service.
Did you
So
finish
then,
your degree?
no. Then in 74, life happened, what we call fall in love. and got pregnant. And so then I went on maternity leave. So that was in 74. So by the time I had the baby in December of 75, the agency had notified me that they had completely got rid of the program. We were called correctional aides, and we would help inmates with phone calls and making sure that they got their lawyers and helping them with, clothing and, toiletries, that sort of stuff. So we were like an assistant to the correction officer in helping them on the social side. So that program had folded. They told us there was no more funding for that, but they were redeploying us to Department of Social Services. So I had just had the baby. I had just got my 6 month, 6 week checkup, and I was still with my mom. And so I told my parents what was happening. So my mother said, you need to work. So go to work. And backtrack a little bit. What they were offering me was the Department of Social Services. Now, let me backtrack a little bit. My father didn't always work 365 days, for a full year. So there were times when my mother had to apply for public assistance. And I remember my mother coming home crying by for the way that she was treated when she went to a welfare center to try to get assistance. And her not being educated, some of the letters that would come in, she would ask me to read, and I would read it to her and tell her why they closed her case and what she had to do to reopen it. And she would just get so frustrated. So I had said to myself, if I ever get a chance to work for social services, I'm going to treat people the way they deserve. See, you got to be careful what you put in the atmosphere. Because lo and behold, they said you could get a job at the Department of Social Services. At that time, it was for a clerical aid position. So it was for even more money. So, and then now I had a baby, single mom. So I took the job and worked there and began to get promoted, through the years. I stayed at Social Services for 14 years. When I left, I was an assistant office manager.
Wow. So Department of Social Services is a state agency or a city agency?
City. Well, it's a city agency, but it gets funded by the state, and the benefits are funded by the state and the federal government.
And back in that day, it was Aid for Families with Dependent Children, AFDC,
Yes,
and
yes. And
Medicaid and food
then it turned
stamps.
into income support. Then it turned into a whole lot of things. Yeah. And then
Okay.
they had the SSI unit, what they call the DAB unit, the disability unit, because that's when SSI first came in. It was a mess. It was, and I worked on 125th Street in Harlem, which was also good for me because I was close to my child care, and be able to get home in case of any emergency. It was wonderful. It was the perfect thing for me.
You want to tell us, particularly memorable story or incident while you were working there?
Oh yeah, I could tell you so.
Tell us one or two. That involves you, that reveals something about you.
okay. So, being young and sometimes being stupid, You do things. I had what they call a lateness problem. So when it got overboard, but they knew I was an excellent worker, that's how I got promoted. So there was one particular director, Mr. Pyatt, I'll never forget him. He has gone on to glory by now. He said to me one day when my lateness time was ridiculous. He said, "Gloria, you know, you could be running this center, but you are stopping you from running this center. And because of that, and because of this report, I'm going to take 10 days' pay away from you. Okay, so hopefully you will learn a lesson." So when he took the 10 days' pay away from me, I learned a lesson. By that time, I had moved out of my mother's house and I had an apartment, so I had to pay rent. So that helped me move into the right direction. But that's one story. The second story, because I did get promoted, I became a PAA, what we call a PAA2, which is Assistant Office Manager.
PA8
PAA, like Apple Apple.
PAA.
It's a principal administrative associate level two, which is a long cry from clerical associate from where I came from. And the one thing with my father, he told me if you ever get a city job, you know, make sure you know your contract, know what you can do and what you can't do. And so, you know, I did that, but I used the contract to help me do not always do the right thing. But once I learned that lesson, I did become a assistant office manager, and it all depends on who likes you and who doesn't like you, whether you keep that position, because it's what they call the broadband position. You take the test for the first level, and if you move up, it's at the discretion of your supervisor, which is something we're still fighting to today. A new director came in, and she had her own plans of who she wanted to be in leadership at the center, still 125th Street. And when she came in, we were at odds. And being young in those days, you know, I was a girl from Harlem. You know, you're not going to talk to me a certain way. You're not going to treat me a certain way because I'm going to tell you about it. So one day, I remember specifically, she was giving me a hard, hard time. One day specifically, she did something. She totally disrespected my position by talking to somebody that was beneath me, that was a subordinate, and changing what I had already planned for the unit. So it was one of those days where the Harlem Gloria just took off, and I went and spoke to the director and closed the door and said some things I probably should not have said. A couple of months later, I get a note, a little piece of paper telling me to report, excuse me, to personnel. So I said, "So what's this about?" Nobody would tell me. When I went to personnel, I found out that I had got demoted and they wanted me to transfer. So I was hurt. I cried. And she did it perfectly because the union people that I worked with was not available that day. I couldn't find nobody on the phone. I was devastated. But I took another site in the Bronx and went there. But y'all know I'm a spiritual person. I keep saying that, right? A year later, I got that position back in the new site because people knew who this other woman was and they saw my ability and they gave me back the position. And then I got an even bigger position to go downtown and work as a training specialist to teach other people the job. And that's where I really got involved in a union.
Let's back up just a minute about the union. When you were a clerical worker, when you started, was there a union there?
Yes, at that
And
time
which you,
it was 1549 DC 37.
AFSCME,
AFSCME,
DC District Council 37, AFSCME. And then when you got, as you rose through the ranks, when you were the PAA, was that then
that was
CWA,
CWA. That was CWA.
local 1180.
Local 1180. Yes.
And for people who may not know, can it's kind of a unique situation, different than the private sector,
Correct.
in that in New York, I don't know if it's elsewhere, but in New York, and I don't even know if it's city or state law, manage low certain levels of management can be in a union. So can you
Correct.
explain a little bit about that and about who CWA 1180 is?
Okay. Just to back up a little bit, when broadbanding came into effect, and what that is the city and the civil services system made a decision, which is civil service system comes from the state, made a decision to do what they call broadbanding. In other words, give tests for a certain title, take away old titles, give tests for a certain title, and then you could broaden that title by doing levels. Once you take the test for the first level, you wouldn't have to take another test for higher levels. So when that happened, PAAs did not have a union, and some of the union representatives that was there at the time said, we need a union, because in order to be what they call a manager, you must be able to change policy as well as have the ability to hire and fire. Our titles were not going to be able to do that. So the powers that be searched around, and CWA Local 1180 said, yes, we'll take you. Well, I think it started with CWA, and then it evolved into a union, 1180, because our charter, I think, started in 1972. You can look that up just to make sure.
So just to clarify this, then the broadbanding was occurring in the late 60s, early 70s, and that's when the PAAs wanted to unionize and
Correct.
decided. And so is that the origins of Local 1180?
It's not, I know the charter was as of 1972. Arthur Chaliotis could tell you better about how the union actually got started. But I know when I became a PAA, this is what they explained to me, that DC-37 was not going to take us because we would supervise their people. So they didn't want to have us in their union. So CWA 1180 became our union.
And when was that that you became a member of CWA Local
I
1180?
believe it should have been like 1980. I believe it was
Okay.
80. I came there in 75, and after tests in 1980. Yeah.
Was it strange to be a unionist who was also overseeing people in another union?
Not to me. I didn't have an issue with it. It gets even more stranger when a level two who is in the same union has to supervise a level one, and the level one gets in trouble, and you have to have the union come represent both of y'all. But we've found ways to figure that out. We represent the person that's in trouble, period. Yep. So it wasn't hard for me to do that. Yep. And we keep relationships with the other unions, and they understand what our role is. Sometimes there are conflicts, but I call us the more professional union. DC-37 likes to holler and scream and bang on the table and all of that. We don't do that. We talk it out. And so it got to a point that we said to the city, if y'all need to meet with us, could we have our own separate meeting? Because they bring 100 people to the table. It's three or four of us. We just want to get to the point and try to settle it. And we have different things that we want to accomplish between the subordinate union and the supervisory union. So the most cases they agree to that.
Are most members of 1180 then in some kind of supervisory position?
Yes. Some are, it depends on the agency. like in HRA where I came from, that's definitely supervised at one level to the other. But if you work in a agency like HPD,
What's
you're not,
HPD?
that's Housing Preservation Development. You don't supervise necessarily because you're an administrative of work. That's the housing unit. So you may work where people are getting low income housing vouchers so that you're preparing the work in a preparation for that. There's some people who are high level PAAs. We also have administrative managers as well as what they call administrative job opportunity specialists. So it depends on the agency whether you supervise or not, but it's high administrative work, high level administrative work that we're doing.
Okay, I think we were at a point where you moved downtown as a training specialist and you started to say you got more involved in the union. So tell
Yes.
us that story.
So as I moved downtown and I saw certain things that were being happened by management, I said, that's not right. I always had a big mouth, as you can tell by now. So people would notice that. And, they'd come to me for guidance. They had a shop steward that they weren't very happy with. No, they were not happy with him. So when it came time for shop steward elections, I was actually on the oh God, the committee that overlooks the election. What you call that, Jeff? My
The election
mind.
committee?
The election committee, correct. Duh. So and people kept saying, Gloria, why don't you run? So I said, Gwen actually called me and said, could you please run? So I said, listen, I'm on the election committee. She said, you can always get off. So I did. I put my name in the hat, and guess what? I won. I got in. That's how I became a shop steward down there. And we were going through some changes because it was the training program for HRA was an excellent program. People had intense training before they actually went into the field, which was needed because you can't get cases done if people don't know what they're doing. But then the program was in jeopardy for funding. So the state was threatening to take over. So I had to get involved in that. And so I had to organize the building because we were at 109 East 16th Street, which was a large training building. So Gwen came to a meeting where I had organized the building and it was like 100 people in the room. And she was just in awe. She's because she, that never happened under Animal's watch. So when an opening happened for staff rep, she said to me, would you like to apply for the position? I said, yeah, I don't know. I didn't know what it entailed. And she explained to me what it was. And I said, okay, I'll apply for an interview. And I did the interview, and lo and behold, I got it.
And this is a staff rep for 1180,
Staff
right?
rep for 1180. That
And
happened
what?
in 1995.
Okay.
So I've been working for 1180 since 1995.
Wow.
Had no idea I would still be here in
Wow.
2024.
Wow. Staff rep for 1180.
Yes.
So you were, how many staff reps were there for the
At the
local?
time, there were. At the time, there were five. There were five staff reps that covered all the city agencies throughout New York and H&H, which is health and hospitals.
Oh, I didn't realize you also had
Health and
folks
hospitals,
there.
yes.
And how many members did you have then, and about how many now?
We kind of been consistent. We had 8,000 members then, and we have 9,000 now.
Can you just tell us briefly the makeup of the local, the different departments that you cover? And I think you've got some other contracts besides
Yes, yes, yes.
the city.
Yes. So, we covered, like I said, every city agency in New York, which includes the Department of Education, NYPD, New York City Housing Authority, the Transit Authority, the Department of Environmental Protection, HRA, I said, which is a huge organization. We, Department of Consumer Affairs, every city agency that you can think of, we have administrative managers or administrative staff in those locations, as well as every city hospital. Health and hospitals are the public hospitals of the city of New York, which has hospitals in every borough, sometimes off sites in boroughs. So there may be two or three different little site hospitals or health clinics in those boroughs. So if we have people there, we cover them there. We also have non-for-profits that we cover. We were steady at seven or eight before the pandemic. After the pandemic, under my tenure as president, which is what's 2020, the not-for-profits was calling to be unionized left and right. So we went from eight to 18 since 2020. And that includes Human Rights Watch, Human Rights First. Oh God, who else do we have? It's off the top of my head, I can't think. We're currently in contract negotiations with the Audubon Society and the Trevor Project. We're doing trying to do first contracts, and they are giving us hell. You would think that because of the mission statements of these non-for-profits, that they would treat their workers in a special way, but no, they don't. They're underpaid, overworked, they do overtime, don't get paid for it. They don't have things like FMLA. Sick time is at a minimum based on the state law. It's unconscionable, some of the things that they're doing with the workers that work at this, which is why they have such a large turnover. Because, you know, while people want to do that kind of philanthropic work, you also have to eat and live in New York City. So some of our not-for-profits are all over the country. We organize the Sunrise group, which is an environmental organization, and so they're all over the country, which is a large group. Trevor, you know, is all over the country, as well as the Audubon Society. But their main bases usually are in New York City, where we could start from there and then get, you know, organize and mobilize members all over the country. And since Zoom happened, that helps a lot because you don't have to be in person, and people make phone calls after work or on Saturdays when potential members are afraid to talk at the work site. So I'm proud of the work that we have done with them.
You should
And which
be.
is the largest of those city units?
Of the city,
Yeah.
I would say HRA.
HRA. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And have you had to have campaigns about outsourcing or privatization of public work? Or that's
Where?
not so much for the middle management.
Not so much for the middle management, but we do work with DC 37 when it happens, because if they lose members, we will lose members. So right now, I had my attorneys do a response to the city where they are saying that they want to privatize 311. So that's a battle I'm currently in. They claim that privatizing it, you know, the calls will be answered quickly, more quickly, and whatnot. That's not so. And the city is trying to save, quote unquote, save money. But DC 37 and I have talked, and we're going to try to fight that as much as possible. And if they do privatize them, we're going to try to organize
Good for
them.
you.
So.
You mentioned DC 37, so let's talk a little bit about bargaining. They're the big gorilla.
Right.
And I don't know what metaphor to use for 1180. How do you do bargaining with the city, given the
Okay.
fact that you're one of the smaller unions?
Okay. We may be small, but we're mighty. The city has the utmost respect for our local, and I'll get to that as to why in a few minutes. DC 37 has the bargaining certificate for citywide issues. So when it comes, they're usually the first one at the table. They fight between UFT, which is a larger unit than them, and PBA, the uniforms. You know, they always think that, and this is being recorded, but so what? They always think they're better than us and they should not get what we get because, you know, notwithstanding, they do put their lives on the line. Okay, but you know, bargaining is bargaining. And what,
PBA or the cops.
yes, what's in the budget is what's in the budget. So they set what has happened is in New York it has become pattern bargaining. So whoever gets to the table first sets the pattern. So what we do is usually wait for DC-37 to come up with the contract as we did the last time. And they put whatever their demands is on the table. Years ago, we used to do bargaining together as to see what the citywide issues are, but that stopped happening somewhere in the 90s, late 90s. So now DC-37 goes to the table. They do what they do, and then after that, you request bargaining for your unit. What has happened with us? We always consider ourselves special. We're not part of AFSCME. We're part of a bigger union, a nationwide union. Where we see a problem, we deal with it, and we demand the respect. In 2018, we acquired a title for administrative managers. They had come to us because they were being treated like, you know what, and they were not in a union at that time. And as I explained in the beginning, unless you are able to hire and fire and create policy, you are not a manager. But yet the city was treating them as managers. So they came to us to ask us to organize them. We did what we needed to do on the public sector side to organize them, went to oath for years because they wanted to. The city is, it's funny. They wanted to interview every administrative manager to see what they do, so for oath to determine whether they should be in the bargaining unit or not.
They
After
meaning
they,
who?
the city asked the judge
Oh,
that
okay.
every administrative manager be interviewed or, you know, come to the trial because you go through oath, which is a trial setting, and determine whether their duties were managerial or not. After years of this case, we won, duh. And so when we acquired them, we start looking at the salaries. Now, years ago, in the 80s and the 70s, white males used to hold that title, administrative manager. Once the civil service test was defined for them, women and minorities stopped passing the test, and the men didn't want that job anymore, the white men. So when we got the title, we noticed that the range of salary was 52,000 to 150,000. Something wrong with that picture. And guess who was making the highest salaries? That was left. So our executive board, we had meetings and we had discussions. We hired an attorney who dealt with EO cases, and the board voted for us to go to file an EO charge against the city because it appeared that once women and minorities started passing the test and they start appointing them, they would hire them at the lowest end of the salary and suppress that. They didn't raise the minimum salary with the raises, they just suppressed the salary. Long story short, after years of litigation, and we took it to EO. EO said, yes, we had a case. So then we had to bring it back to the city and said, okay, we can settle this or we can go to court. So it was under the de Blasio administration. We said, yes, let's settle. But it took us another 3 years to settle that case. So just before the pandemic, 2019, we settled the case and got a tune of $15 million to give to those administrative managers. Some of those administrative managers went from 52,000 to 79,000. Do you know what that means to a family? Plus, they got a little bit of the $15 million. The highest amount was like $7,000 or $8,000 when you divided them up amongst those who had were entitled to the settlement. So the city has a lot of respect for CWA Local 1180, needless to say.
What
When
a
I call
story.
on the phone, I don't have no trouble with people answering. Yep, Arthur was the opener of that case. I was the closer. That's what we call each other.
Wow. Well, you opened a topic that I wanted to ask about, and that is talking about race both in the workplace, representation of our members. You gave a wonderful example, and also within the union.
Yes. So it's funny you should ask that because as a result of the EEO case, we then had discussions with the executive board and staff to say, so we know this is happening in our union. It has to happen everywhere in the city. I said, what can we do? And I have some consultants that I work with that, you know, deal with the city council, et cetera. I said, what can we do to bring this to light and to make sure that pay equity is happening in New York City, one of the most liberal cities in the country. Let's make sure, you know, that we bring this to light. So what we did was work with our attorneys, our EEO attorney and some others, and we made a resolution which passed into law, Local Law 18, which is has my name on it. And I say my name, but it's CWA Local 1180's name on it, which requires the city to form a unit that will look at the statistics of every city agency. First, the law said just a certain particular amount of city agencies, but since then we've evolved to spread it out to more agencies of looking at the pay parity between minorities and white men in the agencies. And a recent report just came out. This is the second report that was done since 2021 when the law got passed. And unfortunately, even under this administration, the pay disparity is still there, especially in agencies where mostly white males are at the top of management. It shows that black women make 84 cents to the dollar of a white male. Okay, in New York City public service. And in those agencies where women head the agencies, like an agency like HRA, where the managers are mostly women, because women like to do service. That's what we do. We're nurturers by nature. They make less as managers than those who, let's say, like are in NYPD, where the lieutenants and the captains and the chiefs are mostly white male. Okay, the wage disparity is unconscionable. So that's been my fight since my tenure as president. I became president in 2018. And we're still in that fight. We just had a hearing and a report just came out. I'll be happy to share it with y'all if you I have your email. I'll be
What
happy to
is the
share it with
report called?
you. I have to look up it's
Okay, that's okay.
I'll have to look it up, but I'll send it to you.
Is there any requirement in the law that then the city do something once they've
Yes.
discovered this?
Yes. What happens is this special unit gives the report and it goes to the city council. The city council reviews it and then they try to make other resolutions and other laws to, based on what they found, to make more efforts for pay equity to happen. There are things that they can do that's already in the law. There's a selective certification on a civil service test that says that if you have certain criteria, certain experience, if you live in New York, you know, we're trying to get them if you have a degree that you get more points on the test so that you're higher up on the list so that you can get appointed. There's certain other resolutions that have happened at the city council where We are working with the city council to see how we can fix that. There's power that DCAS has to make sure that things happen in agency with equity reports that has not been happening because they have taken away the power from, when I say DCAS, that's the Department of Citywide Administrative Services. Used to be the old New York City Department of Personnel, but Giuliani changed that. So now they have no power. Okay, they have rules and they have laws that they're supposed to do, but it's like the agencies do what they want to do. And until the mayor does something to make sure that DCAS can exert its power, it's just not going to happen.
Does the report also look at issues related to Asian and Hispanics?
Yes, Hispanics, Asians, yes, it's Black, white, Asians, and Hispanics. You'll see the report. And then there's the other. Then is there.
LGBTQ plus
Then
also?
there's the other, because
Other.
people don't necessarily identify themselves when it comes to that in city agencies for
Okay.
whatever reason. We have tried to have a pride committee, and only one person has stepped up.
Within
Okay,
the local.
within the local. So, and so
That's
it's
interesting in New York City. Talk about the issue of race within the union, either the local, the district, or the national,
The
because
national.
you're at all levels.
Okay. So my national CWA history goes back a long ways with me being appointed to the human rights. In those days, it was called the Equity Committee. And I was appointed by Chris Shelton, who is, I love him dearly. That's why I got to get there.
I'll see you there.
Yes. And being on that committee enlightened me to so much. Because I think I joined that committee. This is I joined the union in I think I joined that committee in 2001 or two after I became secretary treasurer and became chair of the equity committee. And Chris would never kick me off. He said, "You staying on that committee till I get off as presidency." And that actually almost happened. Till I said, "Okay, Chris, enough now." Even back in 2000, and Jeff, you know this, the executive board did not look the way it does now. Okay. There was one Black man, Brooke Sunkett. There had been a couple of women by then, Barbara Easterling and maybe one or two other people in the sectors, but it was still mostly white males. And through the Minority Caucus, which their mission was to change the face of 11 of CWA, which pushed for the Equity Committee, to have people on the Equity Committee and the Women's Committee, and to give report out at the convention about the disparities that was happening within our own union and the issues that we as a union should fight for. I can tell you, when Black Lives Matter happened a long time ago, that was one of my reports. And I cannot tell you the debate that happened on the floor. I don't know if you were there, but we wanted to name the report Black Lives Matter, and there was some officers from California who objected to that. It should be All Lives Matter. And we had that debate on the convention floor. It was, oh my God, I'll never forget it. 20 years later, now it's Black Lives Matter.
That
Okay.
was
But
during right after Ferguson.
yes, right. But we knew what was supposed to happen. And
Gloria, I will tell you a secret. I was the chair of the resolutions, or I was the staff, not the chair, the staff of the resolutions committee that reported it out as All Lives Matter. So blame me. I needed education then.
Yes. And I'll never forget a young white male. He came to me and said, "I don't think this is right. It should be Black Lives Matter." I said, "Get on the floor and say it." And he did, and the convention was in an uproar. And I have to even say, some of my Black brothers and sisters, basically the president that had the officers' union, told me they could not stand with me. Okay. He since made up for it. I let him know, okay, I forgive you. But, it was just crazy. But that I say that to say unions still have so much to learn about race and the inequity of race. And if we're supposed to be a union of dignity and respect for all, let's mean it, that we need dignity and respect for all, not for some. And I don't need somebody that's other than a color that I am to lead me, for me to make me understand how I should be led. Okay, because that's also some of the problems. So, yeah, a lot of history there. So through the years with the Equity Committee, which subsequently became the Human Rights and Equity Committee, however they call it now. I think it's Civil Rights and Equity Committee now. And that change happened in my tenure as well. It was on the convention floor with Larry Cohen, where some stuff had went down again about, I think Canada wanted its own sector. The minority caucus was up in y'all haven't recognized us, and you want to give the Canadians a full whole sector. So that's when things started to change. And Larry committed to making the diversity members at large part of the executive board. And in the subsequent convention, that did happen.
And you are now one of the at large.
Diversity members at large, yes.
When did that you get elected to that position?
Well, I was first appointed because Carolyn Wade decided to retire, especially after her illness. And then Chris appointed Chris again. Actually, Carolyn recommended me, and the board fully accepted because they knew my history with the Human Rights Committee.
And when was that?
This is 2024. We just had an election 2023. So that must have been 20. I know when it was because it was the year of COVID where we had the online convention.
Oh, poor you. Yes.
Chris said he'll kill somebody before he do
Yeah.
that again. So that was 2020. Yeah.
So tell us what it's like to be an at-large diversity member of the board.
I can only speak from my tenure. I do feel like I have a voice, okay. Because I'm always, like I said, I have a big mouth, so I'm always speak. So especially when Chris was there, Chris knew me well, and he used me a lot too because Arthur was on a DFOC, so and chair of the DFOC, so he would say, Gloria, could you talk to Arthur? So that sort of communication was good for the board. Still, we still making our way with the new leadership with Claude and Amina, but I'm working with them to see where we go next. So it's been interesting. It's been interesting.
That I'm sure. Do you feel like a full member of the board?
Oh, for sure, for sure. For sure.
And
But I like the position I'm in because I'm not beholden to anybody. And I can say what I want to say when I want to say it. I'm not being paid per se as a board member. I'm there because I'm elected and I'm there to represent the presidents of the other unions. So definitely feel like I have a voice, yes.
Do you feel like the work you did on the equity or human rights or civil rights, whatever it was called in different stages, percolated down to the locals? And if so, how? And if not, why not?
Okay. No, and some locals, yes, and other locals, no. Okay, if you look at the local leadership, especially in certain districts, you'll see the leadership is still white males. And some locals are afraid to have women's committees and equity committees because they fear that, they're going to lose their leadership. That's still a fight of the Human Rights Department to create more civil rights and equity committees and women's committees in certain districts. Even in District 1, if you go to South Jersey, there are no equity and women's committees. Okay. North Jersey and New York, yes, they do exist. And it depends on the size of the local, too. That's another issue that the national is going to have to deal with. How much work can you do with a 200 member local? What are you really doing? Okay. Which is an issue. How, there can't be even a political action committee with a 200 member local. The president's too busy doing staff rep work. So that's something that the national is going to have to figure out. When they figure it out, I'm not sure or how. So that issue is still a big problem in certain districts. Okay. And I think you guys know what districts I'm talking about.
Jeff, do you want to, before I switch to another topic, do you want to ask anything follow up to this?
I want to dial back one, but I'll do that later because I don't want to lose this thread. Talk a little bit about the change in 1180 in terms of racial diversity and how that's come. I mean, it just seems like from my experience over this period of time, and I left 12 years ago, so I've missed these past 12, but that there's been a sea change in that direction as well.
Oh yes, oh yes. Well, once Arthur decided to retire,
Well, that helped.
I must say, he did mentor us, the black women in the local. He knew that the local had changed. When he first came, the local was extremely diverse. I would say it had, like maybe 40% white, 40% black and African American, and 20% others. But as the years evolved, because remember he became president, I believe, in 1974 or 5. As the years evolved, more black women and women started taking tests for these titles, and so it was minorities. And that's truly our way to get into the middle class, to take these civil service tests and become public workers. I know it has for me. Okay, I would not be in a position that I am in without the union. I am so grateful to the union. So as he began to mentor us, and he told me when he retired, this is what y'all gonna have to do, blah blah blah. And like I said, when he finally decided, because he had been talking about it for a few terms, but then he's got that fire in his belly. So when he finally decided to do it, he said, "Gloria, I want you to run." So I can't tell you about the anxiety I had. Arthur reads every book. His favorite program is C-SPAN. They what? CNN, C NBC News. He does all of that, and then he writes us emails about, whatever. So I'm living with all this. And I, how am I fill his shoes? How am I fill his shoes? I'm not the same person. And then a little birdie told me, "Duh, you can only be who you are. So don't worry about what Arthur did." And when that light bulb finally went off, then I was able to accept running. So lo and behold, I run. Nobody runs against me. Actually, nobody ran against the whole team in that first election. So I said, "Okay, God, so this is my destiny." Once, like I said, the light bulb went off, I started to think. I had went to Tish James, who's a good friend, by the way, the Attorney General for New York,
Oh my
because
God, I think the world of her.
because we knew we supported her since she ran for council seat. So I got to know her, and I have her cell phone number. She's on speed dial. So I talked to her. I said, "I'm going to run." And she said, "Okay, so what's your platform?" I looked at her. I said, "Now why she got to ask me about a platform?" I was actually mad at her at first, and then I thought about it. She's basically asking me, "So what's going to be your legacy in running this local?" So, and I did think about that. And for me, my legacy is pay parity. Okay. And that's what we've been working on ever since I became the president. So having done that, as I pick my team, because we run as a team, a unity team, I keep in mind that I want a diverse team. So I definitely want to keep the women in leadership, even though we have five males now on the team, both Hispanic and Black. We have the rest of the women. We have an Italian Black woman. We have Hispanics and Black women on our team. So I try to keep it diverse so that we recognize that we are a union of diverse people.
Yeah, I just think it's an interesting circumstance because, I mean, here you're a union of supervisors, and the city essentially for years locked out African Americans, Hispanics, women from those positions. And so as that door gets opened up, that also, represents a dramatic change then within the local as well. And
Exactly.
your leadership team reflects that now, the change that's happened over the past
Absolutely.
50 years
Yeah,
now. So,
absolutely.
And then they inherit the discriminatory pay
Right.
system.
That's right.
And so
That's
that
right.
becomes the fight now that you've gotten into those jobs.
Exactly. Right.
Ensure that
Exactly.
there's a fascinating story
Exactly.
and quite a legacy.
I'm quite proud of the local. Not that we don't have our problems. God knows I've had to change some staff through the years, but you do what you have to do also as a manager and leader, to make sure the local can keep moving and keep going. I'm extremely proud of the work that I have done. That, and I say I, but it's a team effort. Nobody does this work alone. And if you're foolish enough to think that you do, then you will be a fool.
Jeff, you wanted to dial back to something.
Oh, so I was just curious about, I mean, so you came on in the staff of 1180 in 95. So you've lived through some very interesting characters as mayors of New York City.
Oh, yes.
And I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about the experience of dealing with some of the more interesting ones that you've had. I mean, you've gone from Dinkins now to Adams and like all points in between.
I actually met Mayor Dinkins several times. I even knew him because he was the Manhattan Borough President. So I live in Manhattan, so I knew him that way. And we were really, really gung ho with him becoming the mayor, and we pushed for him. But then we had the biggest layoff ever during his tenure. Okay, so that's why he was a one-term mayor. Okay. So then I think we moved to Giuliani. I call him Giuliani, which was horrible for us because we went 5 years without a contract. Well, no, not with him. It was Bloomberg, because after Giuliani was Bloomberg, right? Giuliani changed the face of the city by getting rid of certain agencies. Like I said, DCAS losing its power. He was a law and order man, so he uplifted the police department, NYPD. So we went through whatever change we went through there. We didn't get the best raises with him. But he changed the face of New York City somewhat. Gentrification, which started with the federal government coming on down, that came into play in many phases of his tenure. And then we got Bloomberg, who started out all right. And then as his head swelled up having all this power, he lost his mind. So under him, we went 5 years without a contract. And we had to explain to the members, and as this was every union, because I'm part of the Municipal Labor Committee as well, which is supposed to be a united front of public sector leaders to talk about the issues of health care and whatever else, and contract negotiations with the city. So the MLC agreed, and we all agreed that we not would not do a contract with him because his thing was for us to pay premiums in healthcare with very small wages, and we were not going for that. So it's better not to sit at the table than to sit with him and then have to succumb to that. So then we went back to the table when de Blasio came into play, and you know he gave fairly decent raises, but I will say that Mayor Adams has given us the best raise we have had in over 20 years. Okay, there's other issues with his administration, but I can't say anything about the contract negotiations with him. So it's been interesting living with these different mayors and their different ideologies of what, you know, city workers and public workers should be entitled to. So.
mean, you had 20 years there of Giuliani and Bloomberg sort of stacked up. It's just, and it just seems like it would have been quite a challenge.
You know, and I'll, you know, Bloomberg with all his, because we actually did a campaign about him that he called us and asked us to stop doing. We called it Bloomberg Bucks, and we actually got dollar bills with his picture on it. We did a campaign against him, and it was something specific that we wanted from him. I forget what it is now, but he actually called off and said, "Please stop doing the ads," 'cause and he succumbed to it. Then when he left, Quinn wanted to run, and she was the speaker of the council who was complicit with him running for a third term. So we did a anybody but Quinn campaign for the next mayor. And that's how de Blasio got in. And she's very upset. I see her every now and then at fundraisers. I say hi. She waves back, but she'll never forget Local 1180. Never. So that's
When
why I
you
said the city has a lot of respect for CWA 1180.
Well, when you're a public sector union, your boss is the government.
Yes,
So you have to be political.
absolutely. And we explain that to our members all the time. You know, and I'm proud to say that we have more registered voters in our local percentage wise than UFT does. Okay, because we have explained to our members over and over what we do depends on who we have elected. Okay, so you got to vote. You know, that's something we're getting ready to do a voters registration drive now for the upcoming elections.
And do you make political donations?
Oh, yes, we are allowed to make city and state donations. You know, we have to go through the national to make the federal. We do that through our COPE dollars, you know that.
I think I have two more questions. One of them is, if I'm correct, your local has some very interesting programs for the members, training programs, education programs. Can you talk about those?
Okay. So, in our contract negotiations, we get what they call, God, talk so much. We get monies from the city for benefits. Okay, so we take those dollars. It's right now it's $1,664 per year per member. So we take those monies and we invest them, and we have invested through the years. So with our, and then there's money that we get in bargaining called the additional compensation fund that we can use for additions to growth, annuity funds, etc. So with the ACF, we do have an annuity fund for our members that once they retire, they'll get this money that we have invested. I think it started in like 2000, and it's like $2 a day for every day you work. But through investments, that money now, if you have been in it since the beginning, they get like $30,000 when they retire. That's how
That's
much it's grown.
in addition to their government
Additional to
pension.
their government pension, that's something that CWA 1180 has provided through contract negotiations.
Wow.
Okay. Second thing, through our benefits fund, because the money that comes in from the city that we negotiate, that's $1,664 per member per year. With those investments, We have the Education Training Fund. I'll tell you a little more about that. We have the Benefits Fund that does eyeglasses. Our prescription drug program, we're one of the unions that provide prescription drugs for our members. And we do that through a PBM, and we do a contract to try to get the lowest cost possible. We do dental, we have podiatry service, and we have a short-term disability benefit for our members.
So those are benefits that rather than coming through the city program, the city provides the union the money to then provide those benefits.
Right. And they give us the money, and then we do what we want with it, okay, to provide those additional benefits. The city pays for health care, period.
But they don't
That's
pay for dental or eyeglasses
no.
or
So,
short-term disability.
yes, those are additional benefits that some unions don't provide those benefits because they don't invest. They do other things with it, like pay the high option rider for their benefits. For their members. They may do eyeglasses, but that's it. We in our contract, we request monies for a training fund, which is $100 per year per member. And with that, we have developed an educational program with the CUNY School of Labor. It's now the CUNY School of Labor. Arthur and Greg Mancios and the board envisioned a school for labor activists where they can get a degree in public administration or labor management. So to get that degree, it's done after hours where people can go after work. We provide 30 credits for either their BA degree or their master's degree for them to attain their degree.
You
So
pay for that
yes, the
for
union pays for
college
that
education.
through our education fund. Now, for somebody who already has their BA and go for their master's, we are paying for their master's. So it's a wonderful opportunity for some members. We do 30 credits for the BA, but then they have to do the rest on their own. But that's still a lot of money.
So are these programs then ways in which you bind relationships with the members? They see
Oh,
they're getting concrete things from the
absolutely.
union.
Absolutely. When we had the court case, and the name escapes me right now, Jeff, you might remember the Supreme Court case where they said members don't have to join the union.
Beck, the Beck case.
No, it was a public sector
Oh, the
case.
public sector one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Before we had dues checkoff, didn't matter. You could be a member or not, we still get your dues. Now they have to actually sign the card. So a lot of unions are suffering, public sector unions are suffering from that. We did a campaign to make sure we hit every member. We hired retirees to go around to our shops for those members who had not signed a card to get them to sign a card. Because who better to tell a present union member how good the union is when you're a retiree sitting at home making having income coming in your house? So with that, we have 99% card signage in
Oh my
CWA 1180.
goodness. Oh my
99%.
goodness. Say
Yes,
it again because I talked over you.
99% card usage, card signage in CWA 1180 for the public sector. And I have one person who's specific, that's her job. As soon as we get new members, call them and get them to sign a card.
Yeah. That was
Okay.
the Janice
Yes, the
decision.
Janice case, right? Janice, yeah.
And
But
99% of that number, how many are dues and how many are agency fee
there
or
is no
whatever.
more agency fee payers in public sector. You're
Okay.
either a member or you're not. Now, the
Wow.
private sector still have agency fee payers, but not public sector, thanks to Janice. But
Yes.
that works for us. And I believe it's because our local is mostly people of color. They understand the benefit of having a union. And our court case didn't hurt them understanding that. Okay, I
Beautiful.
understand the Southern Jersey locals are having a hard time because then there's people like the Freedom Foundation that are writing to them to saying, you want a raise? Stop paying union dues. Okay, so we're fortunate in that.
My last substantive question. is talk a little bit about what it's like to be a public sector union within a national union that is largely private sector.
So when I first came to the National Union and being a public sector person, and we're talking about 1998, I felt underrepresented. Okay, I felt like the public sector was second-class citizen. You know, the private sector superseded what the public sector needs were, and for whatever reason. Okay, because you know, CWA started out as a telephone telegraph union, so that's what they were used to. But of course, you know, things change, and if you don't grow the union, you die. So then there was a need to reach out to other sectors to keep the union going. Through the years, and especially because I'm on the board, and especially because I was on the Civil Rights and Equity Committee, and my voice was heard, and through leadership like Chris Shelton, and now Claude, because Claude made sure he came to see us when he was running because he knew how important our votes were. The public sector has grown. We're now 33% of the union. Okay. All right. I even had to explain to a brother who was in the private sector about how important the public sector is to the union today, because he's saying, but y'all don't make as much money as the people in the private sector. I said, I beg your pardon. Okay, my people are making $80,000 to $150,000 in their jobs. What you make? What y'all make? Okay, so we are contributing to the dues structure of CWA, because that mindset in some people are still there. But we've come a long way. We have a lot further to go. There's still talk about what to do with like a public sector vice president, because as you well know, Jeff, the vice presidents don't want nobody coming in their district to organize. Okay, I don't know how we get over that. But with 30% of the union being public sector, I don't think they're going to try to get rid of the vice president for the public sector, but there just needs to be a better role for that person on the board, and we're discussing that.
I'm about to the what I would call the end of the interview summary questions. Before I do that, Jeff, do you have any? You're on mute.
No, yeah, I see that.
And what
Yeah.
about you, Han? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I think the questions you're going to ask are the ones that I would ask, so go
Well,
ahead.
then I'll wait and I'll let you ask them. But before I do, Hannah, do you have any questions? You live in New York City. You probably are a beneficiary of some of the things that Gloria's members do, and you've probably learned a lot about what it's like to work for the city. Do you have any questions?
Sure. Can you mute and on?
Oh, I have to mute. Hold on.
Yeah.
Hi, Gloria.
Hi.
The law you talked about that gathers data on pay equity across racial lines, that was voters voted on that, right?
The city council voted on it.
Okay. I thought I voted for it, but it must.
No, that was, I know what you voted for. There was a resolution in a couple of elections ago about do New Yorkers want equalization in the city of New York. There was some question about that, but that was a different entity. It had nothing to do with Local Law 18. That was,
Okay.
in my opinion, that was just a posh question. Because nothing has been done with that, obviously, from the reports that we have. Yeah. I think it was, do you think it's fair to have pay equity, or it was, I forget what the question was, but I remember voting for that as well. But so
Okay.
now, yes, we believe in it. Now, what y'all gonna do about it?
Exactly. Well, I guess one question I would have is you talked about the importance of your community, your communal upbringing in Harlem, and you're still there, right?
Yes.
So, has your work in Local 1180, have you seen it impact your community in Harlem and folks that you grew up with?
Sure. Of course, a lot of the minority residents in Harlem are city workers, especially in housing developments where they had what we call the Mitchell Llama projects. And I don't know if you know what Mitchell Llama is, but that's when housing was developed years ago for middle income people to live and survive. And they're beautiful housing. It's like places like Concourse Village, Co-op City. There's some places downtown, I forget the names, that's in Chelsea as well, where the rent is reasonable. You're a city worker and you get like an abated price for rent or even ownership. So these things have helped city workers. If you go to HPD Connect, there are housing availability, both rental and ownership, that you can apply for. It's a lottery, but that's how you're able to, upgrade your standard of living. And actually, that's how I am living where I'm living. I do have a co-op, and I'm not a co-op. I have a condo in Harlem. And if it wasn't for the condo that I acquired through HBD Connect to sell it to be able to afford this one, because it's a ridiculous price, but I'm looking to create some generational wealth. If you be, he'll never be a millionaire, but my son, but it'll help him 100 years from now when the good Lord takes me. So it's absolutely instrumental in being able to do public service at the same time, being able to get a decent wage and have benefits after you retire to be able to live and sustain yourself in New York. A lot of people do move to the South because it's cheaper living. But, because this community meant so much to my mother and father, I forgot to tell you, my father, after he retired, became a minister. And my that their mission was to feed the homeless and to clothe the homeless. They used to have two times twice a year, my mother would call people in the projects that she knew, ask them to cook food, and we would have lines of people in the lobby getting food for Mother's Day and Thanksgiving. That's what she did. My father would collect clothes and have it in front of the church for people to just pick up. So that's been instilled in me, so the community meant so much to them. So I feel it's part of my passion to keep upgrading, this community in whichever way and level I can.
That led me to a couple quick follow-ups. First, it's HPD Connect, that's the
Yes.
program.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what it's called today. It was something else before, but.
And what was your father's church? And we didn't talk about religion at all in your upbringing, but maybe add a few sentences about that.
Yeah. Like I said, after my father retired, he became a minister after going through a lot of life changes, trust me. And my mother could tell you the story better than I could. And so we were raised in the church, and in those days you went to church 5 days a week, choir rehearsal, prayer meetings, all of that. So I was raised up in the church, and actually my best friend from the projects, she went to church with me, and then her father joined the church. So we were a little family church. We were part of another church, small family church, storefront churches. My father didn't believe in the big churches. And eventually he started his own church, Mount Pillar Baptist Church, which was a little storefront on Lenox Avenue and 123rd Street. We since moved after his passing. My sister became the minister after that. My older sister, who has passed away as well, and my nephew bought a brownstone in 2000. Thank God he did it then. And the church was in his street level, part of his brownstone, and we served there until the pandemic.
Wow.
And after the
Mount
pandemic, Yeah, Mount Pella,
Can you
MT,
spell?
PAY, like in P, like in Peter, AYLOR, Baptist Church.
And you have one child?
Yes, and
And
two
what's he doing?
grandchildren, two grandchildren.
Congrat, that's the best.
My son, who I learned after losing some money, did not want to go to college. So, eventually he got a job with New York City Transit Authority, and he's been working there for the last 20 something years. So he is also a union person, and right now the president of TW is trying to get him to run for an office, but he don't, my son isn't a people person like me. But he understands the fight, so he's thinking about it. I said, yeah, okay.
Jeff, why don't you ask the final series of questions that we usually ask? You're
Okay, you're on
mute.
mute, Jeff.
So you've had such a great career so far with CWA. Talk a little bit maybe about a frustration that you might have experienced over the course of your time, and then I'm going to ask you about, something that you're particularly proud of in your time with CWA.
My frustration with CWA specifically,
Well,
or
just with your career in general, I guess. Obviously, a big part of it revolves around CWA, but.
yeah, my biggest frustration, especially since I become president, and even as secretary treasurer, because I've been on various boards, is when I go to these union boards, these central labor councils, these municipal labor committees, I'm one of four or five women in a room of 30 or 40 men. Okay. There are a few black men, but mostly white males. Okay. Like I said, I have a big mouth, so they've come to learn when I raise my hand, you better call on me or I'll embarrass you. But being the lone woman in the room is, that's my frustration. I'm actually working with some of the women at CLC to see how we can change this. So that's my biggest frustration. And two, and as I talk to women, a lot of women are intimidated by taking these leadership positions. And even if they are in leadership, they're afraid to be in the room or to say something in the room. And and how do we find ways to change that scenario? So that's 'cause, we need to be in the room. We are the majority, especially in the public sector, of the workers that work in the public sector, because we either are raising our children or we have raised our children, and we need, we're looking for a decent income with benefits. The reason I joined public service, even besides all the other entities that happened, was I'm a single mother. I need to be able to take days off to take him to the doctor or if he gets sick, and I need to be able to be close to home so I can get to him, if I have to. And with public sector work, especially in the city, you don't have to work downtown. You can work in any borough, any location that's available to you. So it's important, that women's issues be heard. And, you've heard the stories about people like in New York City Transit, they're not necessarily our members, but the transit authority workers, the women that work in the subways and whatnot, the bathrooms are horrible. Where do you go to the bathroom? Okay, they're trying to change that these days, but that's why women need to be at the table so they can talk about these things. Excuse the expression, Jeff, but men could piss anywhere. Not so true for women.
And in the city, that happens a lot.
Yes, it does. I see it all the time, trust me.
My daughter lived at 105th and Broadway for about
Really?
10 years. So
Really? I know that area well.
I mean, clearly, as the song goes, you got to be in the room where it happens. So talk a little bit about, and this may be hard to do, but one singular accomplishment that you're particularly proud of. I mean, obviously, you're the first African American woman, first woman to be president of 1180. That's huge, one of the biggest locals in the country. But talk about something that you're particularly proud of over the course of your career.
What am I particularly proud of? There's been so much. Okay. So, there are awards and there are awards. And my office is full of awards. My home is full of awards. I have a room in a storage place with stuff that has awards in it. And so then, after a while, you begin to say, okay, another award. But the one I'm most proud of is the award I got from the NAACP, because that was something that my parents talked to me about, and the struggles, and I get emotional about it, that they went through in the South. And my sister was alive when I got that award. That's the one I'm most proud of. And the woman that gave it to me, I can't think of her name right now. She has gone on to glory too, but it was the most proudest moment I had. And she gave it to me because I was the first woman, and she called me a trailblazer. So thanks for that question, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, it's a powerful, powerful story. I mean, you think about our nation, and we're making slow progress, but over the course of your lifetime, you've leapfrogged that progress to a point where you're in this leadership position that would have been unheard of, 20, 30, 40 years ago. So remarkable accomplishment and a remarkable career. We're lucky to have you, and we're just so thrilled that you joined us for this. This has been wonderful. This 2 hours have flown by. So,
Thanks, Jeff.
Absolute agree. I could have done the whole interview about asking about your family's background, but I knew we had to move on. But I was doing generations when you were talking about your grandparents in South Carolina, or your parents in
Parents,
South Carolina. And I was thinking probably your parents' great grandparents,
We're
if not
slaves.
grandparents, were slaves.
My mother's mother was a slave, and before she passed, we took a road trip on Amtrak to Whitehall, South Carolina, where they were born, and I actually saw the cotton field that I call my great grandmother worked on. My mother pointed out it was so emotional, because when you look at the field and you see the sun beaming on that field, I said, "My God, what did they have to go through to pick this cotton that they did
And
not get paid for?"
even the children who were bringing them water or whatever.
I'm reading a book right now, The Demon of the Unrest, and it's about the beginnings of the Civil War. And I didn't realize this, but it really was focused around South Carolina. South Carolina was the catalyst for the South seceding, and it's a remarkable tale.
Middleton had the slave owner Middleton had the biggest plantation in South Carolina. When we traced our roots, we found out we were from that plantation. And by way of West Africa, by way of the West Indies, by way of that particular plantation. So, and everybody was named after their slave owner. So that's how we got the name. So when I say Middleton to some people, they say, "Oh, are you related to Kate?" I said, "Yeah, by way of another mother."
Probably.
Well, I think we should stop there so that you can get ready for the
Ready,
big shindig tonight. I want to ask a couple questions off tape. So is there anything more that anyone wants to get on tape? Gloria, do you want to add anything that we haven't touched on?
No, I think you covered it all.
Thank you
Well,
so
there's many
much.
more stories I could tell, but we don't have time.
Thank you so much.